It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Each year, as the Three Rivers Arts Festival approaches, many of us rush to check out the schedule to see which musical acts are coming. And if you're like me, you were pretty excited to see that the Smithereens are showing up as one of the headliners this year. Back in the 1980s and early 90s, the Smithereens brought a fresh, tight, transformative sound to modern rock with songs like Blood and Roses, A Girl Like You, and this tune that rose to number one on the U.S. mainstream rock charts, Only a Memory.
Of you, I think about the days of two. I search the room, but you're not there. Your perfume lingers everywhere, but it's only a memory of what I thought was going to be. Only a memory, broken bits of you and me.
Only a Memory by the Smithereens. The Smithereens will hit the Dollar Bank stage at the Three Rivers Arts Festival tonight at 7:30. I'm joined now in Studio A by the driving force behind the Smithereens, lead singer, songwriter, guitarist, Pat Denizio. Pat Denizio, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Good, good. How does it feel to be playing in Pittsburgh in 2014, outdoors, at the Three Rivers Arts Festival?
Well, I can't say because we haven't done the show yet, but it's certainly great to be here. 34 years is a long time to do any one thing, but as I have no job skills for anything else, I suppose we'll continue to persevere. But we celebrated our 34th anniversary together as a band in March.
That's a long time.
Yeah, it sure is, yeah.
You know, we had Billy Bragg here last fall, and he was talking about the state of rock and roll in the early to mid-80s. And the word he used to describe it was flabby. He said hair was too long, and so were guitar solos. And what were you hearing? And did you feel as though the Smithereens fit in with any trend or scene in the early 80s?
Well, it was difficult. I still have a file of rejection letters from every change of A&R regime, artist repertoire. Those were the folks that would give you a record deal or not give you a record deal. It took us 6 years to get a record deal, and that was with a fledgling, a brand new label out of El Segundo, California, called Enigma Records, and they signed us for $2,000. But we were up against it because the hair bands. You know, Bon Jovi, he's got a lot of fans, but a lot of the appeal came from his attractiveness as a performer. He certainly was, you know, charismatic, but it was the era of absolutely huge hair and heavy metal and a certain type of costume that bands wore, and we refused to do that. And, I mean, I was already 30 years old, starting to lose my hair, and it was an epic struggle from the time we got the record deal offer. It was a struggle to keep the label from seeing what I looked like. You know what I mean? Eventually we signed the contract, and they probably said, what did we sign here? But for us, we heard so many compliments, and we got so many letters at the time. Of course, there was no internet. There were no cell phones. And you'd get letters from folks from all over the world. And one of my great joys was to go to the band post office box, the P.O. box, and pick up the mail every day in New York City and read these really heartfelt letters from music lovers all over, of all stripes, you know, from all different backgrounds, saying thank you for bringing real guitars back to the radio.
What was the sound that you were striving for?
Well, I grew up listening to the Beatles, I mean, and bands like the Bo Brummels, the Byrds. Those were our early influences. And in fact, any one who could write a great and memorable and melodic 3-minute pop song, who could get you from point A to point B in 3 minutes or less, those were our role models. But we liked the Kinks, Ray Davies and the Kinks. We liked the Who. I certainly was a big fan of Black Sabbath. So, you know, but I listened to Aaron Copland. I listened to Miles Davis. Debussy, I was listening to everything. And we didn't plan on having any particular sound. I mean, we were inspired by the so-called new wave movement. I remember being very inspired when Elvis Costello's first album came out and Graham Parker and Devo and bands like that. I thought, well, if they can do it, we can do it. But it took us 6 years to get a record deal. So our sound is a hybrid of everything great and memorable musically that we ever heard or listened to that affected our lives, and it sort of just goes through your head and it comes out. If you have any semblance of a unique musical personality of your own, you'll get there.
By 1983, when you were recording your first full-length album, I almost said CD, but back then it was an actual record album and vinyl. You brought in an engineer by the name of Jim Ball, who had worked with John Lennon. How much did that help with what you were trying to achieve in the studio?
Jim, who we refer to affectionately as Jab, J-A-B, Jim, James A. Ball, he worked at the record plant. I mean, the record plant was a mecca for any young band, and especially
major recording studio in New York.
Yes. Well, those folks listening out there, the record plant is at 44th Street and 8th Avenue. Rather, it was right in the belly of the beast in Times Square in New York. John Lennon recorded Imagine there. Bruce Springsteen recorded Born to Run there. Jimi Hendrix recorded Electric Ladyland there. So, I mean, the place had a storied history. So for us to even walk through the doors of that place, get in, and was just an amazing experience. But Jim knew how to work the rooms. He knew the boards. He knew the consoles. You know, he was able to get us the sound that we wanted. And they would take little side projects. And so our initial relationship with Jim was going into the record plant after midnight when no one who had a record deal would want to work. And we would work from midnight till 6 in the morning.
When did he sleep?
I don't know.
Well, by the mid-80s, you're recording, you're working hard on an album. Other bands are being signed to major label deals. And you, from what I understand, still had a day job. For a while, at least, you were working as a garbage collector.
Yeah.
How frustrating was that?
Well, I was reminded. My dad passed away several years ago, and his adopted son through marriage, the fellow that married his second wife's daughter, told me, Pat, that's how he talks. He goes, you remember, he goes, you wrote Blood and Roses on the back of the garbage truck. He goes, you were hanging on the back. You go behind somebody's house, you pick up their garbage. Then you come up to the front and we drive a little bit and you had a notebook and a tape recorder. And I had completely forgotten that half of the songs that I wrote for the first album were written on the garbage truck, and probably my state of mind being, you know, I really don't want to do this for the rest of my life, because I was involved in a family business that my grandfather had started in 1940. And it progressed, you know, from picking up cans of ashes, walking up 8 flights of stairs, to, you know, and dumping it, taking it to the dump, to having 2 garbage trucks. It was a small family business. And it wasn't for me, you know. I felt the calling of music and art when I got my first guitar when I was 7 years old, after I saw my first band play. I was in a band, Paul, before anyone had ever heard of the Beatles, when surf music was popular in the Four Seasons. The Jersey Boys were popular. So I've been doing this ever since I saw Elvis Presley in the film King Creole in 1959. You know, but the garbage truck was not really where I was meant to go.
But you were still able to write songs on the back of
I was,
the
yeah.
That's
that,
amazing.
Yeah, that was instructional, because I had no idea. I'd completely forgotten that a lot of the material was written in the frustration of doing a job that I felt trapped in, that I was unhappy with.
I want to jump ahead to 1991. There was a Smithereens album called Blow Up, mm-hmm. which featured cover art designed by Saul Bass. Saul Bass, for anyone who hasn't heard of him, is the man who designed title sequences for movies including Alfred Hitchcock classics like North by Northwest and Psycho. How did he come to design that album cover for you?
The Smithereens have been influenced by pop culture and artists like Saul Bass as much as anything that we listen to musically. So I knew of Saul Bass. He was the greatest graphic designer of the modern era, at least to my taste. Not only had he done Vertigo for Hitchcock, but he did West Side Story and Ocean's 11 and The Longest Day and Exodus, and he had done the corporate logos for United Airlines and Bell Telephone. It's like it was ubiquitous. Everywhere you looked, there was something Saul Bass had created. And one of my dreams was to work with him. And we sent him some of our records. And we got a phone call. And he said, you know, my children are big fans of your work. And he goes, and after looking at these album covers, you need me. And, you know, he didn't need us, but it was kind of neat. He liked us. He was a genuinely nice man. I mean, he storyboarded and directed the shower sequence in Psycho. And not only that, but he worked with Martin Scorsese at the end of his life. He did the titles for Goodfellas, The Age of Innocence, Casino, that whole era of Scorsese. And he would tell us remarkable stories about how the work was achieved very inexpensively and in an organic way using things. And his office was filled with primitive art objects that were priceless. And none of it was behind glass. And we were afraid to touch anything. And he goes, oh, go ahead. And he goes, these items, these tools were used by real people centuries ago. They're meant to be touched. And we learned a lot. I mean, just something like that, that he didn't hold these things so sacred that, you know, or he didn't buy things for investment. He bought them because they were part of our history. So,
I'm looking at the cover of the CD of Blow Up, and the Saul Bass touch, it's unmistakable. Let's listen to a track from Blow Up. This is a tune called It's All Right.
Then he said, take your time and good night. It's alright if you want to come home. It's alright if you're better alone. Since you left yesterday, black and white has to pray. It's alright, it's alright.
It's All Right by the Smithereens. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is the great Pat D'Annunzio, frontman for the Smithereens, who are headlining at the Three Rivers Arts Festival tonight at 7:30 on the Dollar Bank stage. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email address, ESSPGH@WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. Back in the mid-80s, as you were, we were talking about how you were struggling to get those songs on the radio, get the albums recorded, and somebody to pay attention. Eventually, by 1990, you had a Billboard Top 40 hit with the song A Girl Like You. What did it feel like to finally get there after all the struggle you went through?
Well, seriously, it was a bit anticlimactic. We were really happy that A Girl Like You hit the top 40. We were able to do Saturday Night Live. That was amazing. I looked up as we were performing. I looked into the audience at the Saturday Night Live NBC studios, and there was the great beatnik poet legend Allen Ginsberg smiling at me like a Cheshire cat. You know, you have these weird things. But A Girl Like You was number one at rock radio. It was number one at college radio. And it was also top 40, and what I was struck by was our luck, our real fabulously good luck at being able to become successful in each different format without alienating any one group. It seemed like there was a universal appeal to the group. The real moment for me was when I first heard Blood and Roses on the radio, at a station called WNEW-FM in New York, and they were the straw that stirred the drink, in the words of Reggie Jackson of the New York Yankees, for FM radio. As WNEW went at that time, so did the rest of the nation. When I heard Blood and Roses on the radio, I literally fell to my knees and started to cry, because it was 6 years is a long time to do any one thing, you know, and I thought, I didn't trust it, but I thought, we may be on to something here, you know, because we never, Paul, we never expected to sell more than 3,000 records, and we wound up selling millions. And, you know, in fact, the last studio album, Smithereens 2011, it outsold everyone who put out a similar pop record that year. And it's not to say that sales are the most important things, but it means that what we're doing is still alive musically, that it's still of a certain caliber that people will actually buy it.
You, there's an interesting story behind A Girl Like You.
Yeah.
There's a female backup vocal on that song, and I understand that you talked to Madonna about singing that part. Can you tell us the story of what happened?
We had the same attorney. I read in Rolling Stone magazine. I had a bit of a crush on Madonna, as most of the young men of America did back in the 80s. And in the interview in Rolling Stone, when she got the cover, they said, why did you pick your manager and your booking agent and your lawyer? And she goes, well, I looked at who the biggest pop star in the world was, and I went and got Michael Jackson's people. So when we got our foot in the door of a career, Paul, I looked at who Madonna's people were, and we got her lawyer and her manager and all that. I just copied her, basically, in terms of business stuff. And I heard through the grapevine that she was covering Blood and Roses on the Who's That Girl tour, where she put out an album called True Blue. And I met her after the show, and she goes, yeah, she goes, I'm a big fan. She goes, we were doing Blood and Roses as a tribute to Marilyn Monroe, but I couldn't do it as good as you, so we dropped it. So I knew her. And when we recorded A Girl Like You, I had been influenced by Bruce Springsteen's song Tunnel of Love, where his soon-to-be wife, Patti Scialfa, is kind of like scatting and singing toward the fade at the end. She's trading off verses with him. And I thought it would be interesting to bring a female voice into one of our recordings, although we had done it with Suzanne Vega on her first album, Especially For You. She sang a bossa nova duet with us on a song called In a Lonely Place. Anyway, we had the same manager as Madonna. And our manager, Freddie, called her at my behest. And I got a phone call one morning as we were recording. And I picked up the phone and I said, yeah. And this voice says, is Pat there? And I said, yeah. And she goes, it's Madonna. She goes, I really love this song. I want to sing on it. And she asked all the right questions, like really intelligent. Of course, I'm doing a parody of her voice, you know. But she asked the right questions. She said, I really like the lyrics. She goes, who does the guitar solo? She goes, is that you? I said, no, it's Jimmy doing the first half and me doing the second. She goes, okay. And she was supposed to sing on it, but she was in the middle of a movie called Dick Tracy, and she was having a romance with Warren Beatty. And on the day she was due to come by the studio, they broke up that morning, and she just couldn't cope with anything. So for me, it was the difference between top 40 and top 10, because she had never sung on a rock tune before, and I knew that she would hit it right out of the park.
The Smithereens have often paid homage to the music of the 60s, and you were talking about it earlier. You had guest performers on your albums like Del Shannon and 60s girl group The Honeys, and you also did a track-by-track cover album of Meet the Beatles called Meet the Smithereens. What does music from the 60s evoke for you?
It evokes a lot of very, very happy and amazing memories. When I hear a song on the radio, if I'm listening to an oldie station, I'll think of, for example, there's songs that I heard for the first time while I was driving along with my dad in our 65 Chevy Malibu, on the way to go see a James Bond movie, perhaps. I mean, it sense memories of things, you know. The songs from that era put you right back where you were when you were younger, and they hit you right where you live. I remember when I first heard Yes It Is by the Beatles from Beatles 6. I was sitting with my dad in the car, and we're just driving around. Back in those days, time seemed to just last forever. And on a Sunday afternoon, you were bored. Let's get in the car and drive around. Let's go look at the planes take off and land at Newark Airport, stuff like that. But I think it works that way for everybody. You know, and I don't want to be one of these old-timers who says that music was better back then, but I think in terms of pop craftsmanship, writers like Carole King, you know, Ray Davies of the Kinks, Lennon McCartney, Jagger Richards, Buddy Holly, people I admired, Pete Townsend from The Who, I don't really hear anybody these days that's writing songs up to that level. songs that really grab you and stick with you. And I'd love to see something new that does that to me, but unfortunately I haven't.
Let's listen to a track from Meet the Smithereens. This is your version of the Beatles' This Boy.
That boy took my love away, though he'll regret it someday. This boy wants you back again. That boy isn't good for you, though he may want you to. This boy wants you back again.
That is incredible. Now, is that you harmonizing with two of the other guys in the group?
Yeah, we did it exactly the way the Beatles would have done it. You don't mess with perfection. We approached that Beatles record, our reimagining of that astonishing, classic, and influential first Beatles American release on Capitol. It wasn't with the Beatles. It was Meet the Beatles, and a decidedly different album from its British counterpart. It's as though we were a string quartet, a classical string quartet, with sheet music in front of us by Mozart or Bach. You play the notes as written. You can't mess with perfection. Those songs were perfectly arranged the first time. We don't try to do a reggae version of This Boy because we've got to make it our own. We made it our own simply by playing the notes as written, but not singing and trying to imitate them, using our own unique musical personalities, our own guitar tones. And, you know, classic music aficionados will recognize certain quartets or certain artists by their own unique style. They can spot it a mile away. So you've got our guitar tones, our attitude, and our voices playing Beatles stuff as written and recorded.
And it sounds great. We're tight on time, but Jim in Oakland has been holding. He wants to get on and chat before we wrap up.
I love the show, and I always love the Smithereens. I'm blind, and I love music. I listen to all kind of music, and I play the piano a little bit. But, no, I love the show, and I'm going to be down on the Arts Festival tonight listening to the Smithereens on stage.
Well, Jim, this is Pat. Come by and see us after the show. Say hi, right?
I'll try to do that, yeah. I'll try to do that, and that'll be so nice.
Thank you, my friend. look forward to meeting you.
Oh, you bet.
All right,
I'll
Jim.
I'll be there. Okay.
See you tonight.
Thank you, Jim. And, again, the show is tonight at the Dollar Bank Stage, 7:30. The Smithereens performing as headliners at the Three Rivers Arts Festival. And my guest has been Pat D'Annunzio, lead singer of the Smithereens. And, Pat, it has been a pleasure getting a chance to sit down, meet you, and talk with you and hear the story behind so many of the great songs that were a part of my growing up and a lot of other.
Well, Paul, thank you. It's nice to have someone to actually talk to about this stuff because, it's in my head and it's in my heart and all, and it's nice to be able to communicate this and hopefully people are actually interested in how the songs were written and how these records were created and all that.
I think you'll see a healthy crowd down there tonight. Thanks again, Pat.
Thank you, Paul.
Coming up, travel contributor Elaine LaBalme takes us to regional beaches. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.